Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Do you remember this scene from 2015's Mad Max Fury Road?
Do not, my friends, become addicted to water. It will take hold of you, and you will resent its absence.
Super freaky Immortan Joe there, looming over his people, shutting off a momentary water supply as parched and dirty peasants below fight over mud puddles. Well, dystopian for sure. But a series of recent international climate reports puts the worst-case scenarios for climate change about drought, fire, migration, starvation, and floods potentially in Mad Max territory, especially if world leaders right now continue to dither. For example, just last week, Brazilian Foreign Affairs Ambassador Ernesto Araujo said, quote, "Doesn't seem like a climate catastrophe to me."
From the debate that's going on, it would seem that the world is ending. And that's the whole point of climatism. Conveyors of that ideology want to create a moral equivalent of war in order to impose policies and restrictions that run counter to fundamental liberties.
Well, this hour on Point, it might not be highly probable, but it is certainly possible. We will imagine ourselves into the worst case scenario for climate change and what must be done to avoid it. And you can join us. What do you imagine? What do you think the worst case climate scenarios are regarding drought, regarding floods, regarding mass migration? Are we ready for that scenario? Or does it sound like a lot of fear-mongering to you? Join us online on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, this conversation was inspired by a recent piece in the New Republic titled "The Blood-Dimmed Tide: Climate Change is Poised to Alter the Face of Global Conflict." It was written by Emily Atkins. She's a contributing writer at the New Republic, and she joins us from Washington. Emily, welcome to On Point.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us today. So before we get into kind of the specific scenes that you imagine in the year 2100, can you tell us, first of all, sort of what this thought exercise that you went through is based on regarding the different scenarios that scientists have say are possible if climate change continues?
Absolutely. I decided to take on this piece and lay out the worst case scenario because part of my job as a climate change reporter is to read the science when it comes out, specifically the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, big reports that often get a lot of attention. And often when I look, you know, deep into those reports, not just the summary for policymakers, you go in and you see that there are a range of different scenarios that climate scientists base their predictions off of when they're making judgments about what might happen in the future, because we don't know what's going to happen in the future, right? So if we're making predictions about what's going to happen with climate change, we have to have a couple different scenarios. And I noticed they were called the shared socioeconomic pathways, and there were five of them. And some of them were really great. They assumed that we took action really quickly. They assumed that we started to collaborate with other nations in order to adapt to challenges really quickly. And those scenarios were really great. SSP1 is the one that is the best one, right? That's I think it's called a sustainable future or something like that. But I also noticed, you know, and there was like a middle of the road one called SSP3, and some complicated ones, SSP4, SSP5. But SSP3 was called the regional rivalry scenario, and it scared the crap out of me, honestly, because it was a scenario in which basically the trends that are happening right now just continue throughout almost the middle of the century. And that's in that scenario, and this is one that climate scientists use. You know, it's not something that I just made up, right? And that's something I really want to put out there, is that I didn't make this up. This is based on science. That's the one where we don't really do anything to reduce our emissions until maybe 2035, 2040, until we're well past 1.5 degrees Celsius, right, of warming. We start to get our act together to reduce emissions, but also at the same time, the trend of nationalism in governments, authoritarian type leaders whose ideology really surrounds, you know, our country first.
Right.
That starts to expand and take hold in other nations.
Okay, so let me just jump in here. So now that you've sort of set the table here for us, that you're using actual data that science has provided, as you said, in the International Panel on Climate Change's reports. Let's kind of step by step go through your imagined scenario here. So you project us forward to the year 2100, right?
Yes.
And so first of all, you were talking about nationalism. Tell us, why is it that it's possible that nationalism that we see already on the rise in several countries, you imagine, because of climate change, may become a worldwide phenomenon?
Well, I don't imagine it. Again, this isn't based on my imagination. This is based on the SSP3 scenario.
Okay.
And so I imagine it because it's just something that scientists are they want us to be able to plan for that if that does indeed happen.
And so tell us, I mean, you write about it in a very compelling way, though, that what are the consequences then of the continued rise of nationalism in the face of climate change? What does that engender then?
Well, when you're a country that's focusing just on yourself, especially, you know, perhaps a richer country, you're just, you know, there are other countries that might need help adapting to climate change via support, maybe investments in renewable energy. If they're not getting that support, then they're going to rely on extractive measures of energy, just the basic ways that everybody else around them has gotten rich, right? So at the same time, they're not getting help from other countries to adapt to climate effects. The developing countries also start worsening climate effects by using dirty energy, coal, et cetera. And at the same time, countries that are nationalist in nature are often hostile to migrants. Mm. And so what I imagine, and also just what I read about predictions if this happens, is increased migrations due to people fleeing unhabitable areas, but then coming up against militarized borders, hostile nations, it fuels conflict. Countries that are already at war with each other, if they then are in a climate war, it all just exacerbates itself.
Right. So you talk about how, and it's worth repeating, this is all based on projections that have been put into major international documents. So I'm not just attributing it to your imagination alone, but
right.
But you talk about how nationalistic governments across the world, basically in your piece, you say tribal political divisions and the human race's retrograde hoarding instinct plunge nationalist powers into a regressive rivalry to seize scarce resources, and that leads to the pushback against migration and the militarization that you were talking about. What about the sheer? We'll talk more about the political implications here, but what about the sheer just climatological changes? How much is major drought a part of this future?
Well, in this scenario, it's 2100, right? Mm-hmm. And the world has warmed 4 degrees Celsius. That's sort of what the scenario says. If these trends continue, we warm 4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. So in order to figure out the answer to your question, so what does the water situation look like, right? What do droughts look like? So I start looking all over the scientific literature for drought at 4 degrees Celsius, right? Mm-hmm. And what I basically find is that 5.5 billion people all over the world live in water-stressed areas. And it's not just your typical desertification of already dry areas. It's, you know, areas that were once supplied water, you know, like the mountain glaciers that supply water for Pakistan and India. 2/3 of those mountain glaciers, they're gone, right? And that starts potentially a conflict with China, because China holds basically they control the third pole, which is this massive water source in the Himalayas. And so, you know, they cut that off, and then the water remaining can't drain into India and Bangladesh. And then so a conflict spurs from that. Again, in Africa, Africa also experiences extreme desertification. However, the studies there about migration, about how people in Africa will respond to that, say that they predict that most people won't flee, they'll stay. Mm. And so that increases the risk for conflict there over water resources. It's, you know, it's not a pretty scenario.
I mean, you talk about how farming practices in certain places don't change, even in the face of, as you write, Saharan intensity becoming the norm in Europe and North America. So what is it in the scientific literature? We've just got 30 seconds before I have to take a quick break here, Emily, that made you imagine, look into a future and see that even in the face of these massive climatological changes, certain things like farming practices don't change in certain places?
Well, people don't like to change even when things are in front of them that are uncomfortable and maybe say you should change. I mean, that's something I see all the time just being a climate reporter. That's the number one theme you have. So I wasn't necessarily struck by it. I just thought to myself, yeah, makes sense.
Well, we are talking this hour with Emily Atkin. She is the author of a new piece in the New Republic titled The Blood-Dimmed Tide. Climate change is poised to alter the face of global conflict. We are looking into a future where the worst case scenario of climate change might await us. And are we prepared to cope with it? This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what the world might look like in the year 2100 if we do nothing about climate change now. And our conversation is inspired by a piece by Emily Atkin. She's written in the New Republic, a piece titled The Blood-Dimmed Tide, Climate Change is Poised to Alter the Face of Global Conflict. And she took a look at what the scientific literature says about what the globe might look like environmentally and politically if climate change continues unabated. And she says in her piece, for example, around 80% of the Earth's coral reefs died off by 2100, tanking fishing and tourism economies around the world. The ocean rose about 1.5 feet, exposing an additional 69 million people every year to regular extreme flooding. Residents of the tiny Pacific island nation of Kiribati, which sits on an average of a little less than 6 feet above sea level, began to flee Australia and New Zealand en masse. That's from Emily Atkin's piece, Looking at the Future. But as Emily and other folks well know, The residents of Kiribati are worried about this right now. For example, here is the former president, Anote Tong. He's traveled around the world talking about the threats posed to climate change to his nation. They're already dealing with migration and scarcity issues. So here's Tong in an interview last year with the Australian news show The Feed.
Let's forget about negotiating against nature. Come on, let's wake up. It's not about that. It's about what nature can continue to take. Are we moving beyond the threshold point? And if we are, it doesn't matter who wants what. We'll all be gone. We may be the first ones to go.
That's former Kiribati President Anote Tong speaking last year. Emily Atkin also points out in her piece that it's not as if world leaders weren't warned. So with that in mind, let's listen back to what President Donald Trump told reporters in Biarritz, France at the G7 just last month. He said he would not let fears about climate change slow down America's energy exports, especially in liquefied natural gas.
We're the number one energy producer in the world. Soon it will be by far the number one. It's tremendous wealth. And LNG is being sought after all over Europe and all over the world, and we have more of it than anybody else. And I'm not going to lose that wealth. I'm not going to lose it on dreams, on windmills.
President Donald Trump speaking at the G7. Let's go to the phones. Michael is calling from Sharon, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Meghna, how are you? Thanks for having me. So I guess my comment would be that I think Mother Nature is an awesome power, and it's a power that we have been messing with for far too long. I mean, I think if I can think back, you know, I'm in my 50s, and I can think back to my childhood and climate in New England back then and versus climate in New England now. I think the signs have been there for quite some time. However, our political leaders, not all of them, but largely around the world, especially in the current administration, have continually rolled back efforts to put us in a position to where we can finally start to turn this around and reduce our emissions. So, you know, do I think it's too late? No, I think there's time. I think the window is closing, and it's closing quicker than we think. Do I think we're in a position as a global force to deal with the fallout of what we're talking about here today? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I don't think we can't bail out a hurricane, a city ravaged by a hurricane. How could we possibly handle this on a global scale? Our political leaders are too busy bickering about, you know, and we can't even get anybody to agree on the topic, never mind put ourselves in a position to where we can start to move forward and make real change. And,
yeah,
you know, I have kids, Megan, and it's a concern. And I don't think I'm overreacting. I don't think I'm being paranoid. I don't think I'm being doom and gloom.
Mm-hmm.
Mother Earth will be fine. Humanity,
but
maybe not so fine.
The question is, what will happen to us? Michael, thank you for your call. Emily Atkin, let me turn back to you here because, I mean, you heard Michael talk a couple of times there about his disappointment in political leadership. And in your piece, again, you're looking back from the point of view of the year 2100 or what's happening in 2100. You say regarding political leadership that no one in power could credibly say they weren't warned, but regarding could they plausibly say they did everything they could? Few could say they even tried. Across administrations here, so talk to me more about that. I mean, because there's a lot of focus on the current Republican administration, but, you know, President Barack Obama didn't get a cap and trade agreement past the United States.
Yeah, and I think that people don't realize that we had very dire warnings about this back, in the year I was born. I was born in 1989. I'm about to turn 30. And I'm going back and I'm looking at warnings about climate change, and I'm seeing George H.W. Bush on the campaign trail promising to do something about climate change to fight the greenhouse effect with the White House effect. I'm seeing him have a deputy assistant secretary of state who writes to him in 1989, the year I was born, if the climate changes within the current range of predictions, then the consequences for every nation and every aspect of human activity will be profound. I mean, this is the kind of quote unquote alarmist language that we're doing, that we're saying today. That's 30 years ago. So what happened? What happened was, you know, a network of people with a lot of money who had money in extraction industries realized what it would mean if we fought this problem, and they fought tooth and nail within the Bush administration and within every other administration to make sure action never happened, and that happened across administrations.
We'll come back to this thought in a minute, but let's go to Jimmy, who's calling from Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Jimmy, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Go ahead, Jimmy.
Can you hear me? My question is, the topic seems to be about the worst-case scenario and the coverage of that in the book. But I was wondering, even if it's the best-case scenario, even if we do everything possible to stem climate change at this point, if we do nothing about population growth at the current rate, I guess what, the population doubles every 50 years, isn't it going to be a moot point in a couple hundred years, even if we do everything perfectly? Just from a farming and freshwater standpoint, aren't we going to be back where we are now, where we're in some type of a crisis that we can't fix? I just wonder why, in all the progressive news that I read and listen to, I never hear anybody say, none of this matters if we don't stop having babies, we're all done for in 200 years regardless.
Jimmy,
I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks. Yeah, Jimmy, thank you for your call. And Emily, I should know that every time we do a climate conversation, I get a lot of responses from listeners afterwards saying, you did not talk about population.
And I'm really glad he asked that, actually, because the next thing I'm working on for the New Republic that's coming out soon is a podcast episode about this very question. It's basically, I'm looking to all the people who say they're not going to have kids because of climate change. And I came across this really interesting argument that really changed the way I think about it, which is that if we do everything right, you know, if we do everything and create this society that we want and avert catastrophic global warming, we will have created a net zero carbon economy. That means that our economy won't actually produce any carbon into the atmosphere. That means that me, when I walk around and I do my thing every single day, I am a net zero person. And so if I'm emitting net zero emissions, it doesn't really matter how many people there are in the world if we're all emitting net zero. So there will, of course, be resource concerns, water concerns, extraction concerns for other non-fossil fuel things. But in terms of climate change, population is not – it's not even close to our biggest concern. Our biggest concern is creating a net zero society so that everyone on Earth doesn't contribute to climate change.
Interesting. I mean, because I think some folks listening to that may not buy it from the sheer point of view of that increased population. The thought is it naturally leads to increased consumption, which contributes to climate change.
Of course, but think about what we're trying to do. I mean, in order to do this, we make consumption carbon neutral. We're trying to figure out ways to power our society with renewable energy. We're trying to figure out ways to make the agricultural system carbon neutral. So we're eating, we're living our lives. You know, we're trying to make cement and manufacturing carbon neutral. We're buying things, and it doesn't contribute to climate change the way it does. That's the utopia. We talk about worst-case scenarios, but the best-case scenario, this is the best-case scenario, and we have to strive for that. We can't start, you know, telling people to have less babies.
Well, Emily, stand by here for just a second, because I want to sort of now focus in on an aspect of what you write about, which are the security implications of an unchanged path on climate change by 2100. This is, in fact, something that people in the world of defense and national security have been talking about for quite some time, from heat-related risks for troops to naval security issues. So National Intelligence Council counselor Peter Kimmel testified at the U.S. House Intelligence Committee's National Security and Climate Change hearing in June, and here's what he said.
We assess the security risks for the United States linked to climate change will arise primarily from distinct extreme weather events and from worsening pre-existing problems, such as water and food insecurity around the world, as the chairman has already alluded to. Many scientists warn that the risk of abrupt climate change, which would have the most severe national security implications, will increase over the next several decades and beyond, although currently it is assumed to be low.
Well, joining us now is Francesco Femia. He's co-founder of the Center for Climate and Security, a nonprofit group made up of military, national security, and foreign policy experts who are concerned about climate change. Francesco, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
So first of all, I mean, in a sense, it almost seems, I don't want to say counterproductive, but a little counterintuitive to talk about individual national security risks when climate change is such a global phenomenon. But tell us, I mean, what is it that people in the world of defense and national security see as even just immediate term risks, let alone 2100?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that, you know, despite the fact that we're talking about long-term projections here and catastrophic scenarios in 2100, the Defense Department here in the United States, for example, has identified climate change as an immediate threat to national security, which I think is quite extraordinary. And we actually saw during a Republican Congress a national defense bill get passed that also identified climate change as an immediate threat to national security. That ended up in a defense bill that was signed by the current president. Whether or not he knows that was in the bill is an open question, but that's the case. And so so the defense community understands that it's a security risk. The intelligence community in the past 12 worldwide threat assessments, which are basically the entire entity of intelligence and basically the entire network of intelligence agencies puts out a worldwide threat assessment every year. And in that assessment, every year for the past 12 years, climate change has been noted as a security problem. And so they're worried about it. And essentially, I think the worries extend beyond sort of, you know, just the specific, you know, security problems that were mentioned you know, during that hearing. I think actually the intelligence community and the defense community are quite worried about these future scenarios as well. And, you know, you see these scenarios in the IPCC, as Emily was talking about before, but the defense community and the intelligence community do this kind of scenario exercise as well, and they're seeing some pretty catastrophic futures as well. So I think this is not just the scientists. We're also hearing this from our security professionals, and that should worry everybody.
Francesco, I was wondering if you could tell us in more detail, though, like, is, again, I just named a couple of very simple ones, like just the sheer heat is having an effect on members of the United States military. But there are bigger issues, right? I mean, is the Defense Department and the National Security Establishment looking at what the knock-on effects of mass migration might be on U.S. national security? I'd love to hear some more specific examples of what areas folks are looking at as potential threats.
Absolutely. I mean, there's certainly a concern about direct effects on national security, for example, on military assets, military infrastructure. Just last year alone, you know, the hurricane season resulted in over $8 billion of damage to defense installations. So that's a big deal. But those are very specific, and that's just one small part of the picture. The defense community, intelligence community, is also worried about these knock-on effects and the broader strategic risks associated with climate change. Emily has sort of talked about some of those in the scenarios, but certainly, for example, those in the military, say the commander of Africa Command or Central Command, who are responsible for, you know, an area of operation of responsibility in those regions, in Middle East and North Africa and in Africa, are concerned about the intersection of climate change, water resources, and political instability. I think it's important to note that when we talk about these long-term projections, those are not just based on sort of, it's not just scientific speculation. It's also the past is prologue.
Yeah.
And the present is prologue. So if you look into the, you know, the past and the past century, even when there was a perception of resource scarcity, authoritarian leaders like Adolf Hitler in the Nazi government, you know, basically justified mass atrocities against Jews and against Roma, in part on the concept of Lebensraum, which was these ethnic minorities are taking your land, they're going to take your land, we have to protect it. And that was based on a false sense of resource insecurity. In the present and in the recent past, we've seen climate change impacts. For example, Syria experienced its worst drought in its recorded history from 2006 to 2010. That, along with natural resource mismanagement, contributed to the displacement of 2 million people within Syria. This is all before the civil war broke out. And in part, the intelligence community and the broader security community kind of missed that moment of Syrian instability because we weren't looking closely at those water and resource factors that contributed to conflict and instability in Syria, which is now having obvious spillover effects into global politics and this rise of ethno-nationalism in a number of countries. So that's happening already. And then so when you project out into the future where we're looking at even greater actual significant stress on water resources, on food resources, then, you know, we're likely to see an even greater increase in global migration, regional migration. And what does that do to our global politics? What does that do to the security landscape? Are we going to see more nations turn inward? We're going to see greater ethno-nationalism. Is that going to be disruptive to the global security environment that's kept peace since World War II, or at least, you know, relatively? So, you know, that's a big problem. We're worried about that.
Well, Francesco Femia joins us this hour. He's co-founder of the Center for Climate and Security. Emily Atkin is also with us. She's written a piece for The New Republic titled The Blood-Dimmed Tide. Climate change is poised to alter the face of global conflict. We'll be right back with a lot more. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about what the future might look like in the year 2100 if the worst-case scenarios for climate change are realized. And Emily Atkins is the one who's inspired us to have this conversation. She's written about this in The New Republic in a piece titled The Blood-Dimmed Tide, Climate Change is Poised to Alter the Face of Global Conflict. Francesco Femia also joins us. He's co-founder of the Center for Climate Security, a nonprofit group made up of military, national security, and foreign policy experts who are concerned about climate change. And we want to hear from you. If we head down the path and don't do much to mitigate climate change, we will actually be in the future that Emily writes about in her piece by the year 2100. Is it already too late? Or are you one of the folks who thinks this is a lot of fear-mongering? Let's go to Martin, who's calling from Mansfield, Connecticut. Martin, you're on the air.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. The points I'd like to make are that we really are doing ourselves a disservice by focusing just on a very narrow window of our time on Earth, thinking that we have to end our carbon emission by 2040 so that we can mitigate what's going to happen at 2100. The two things, one, we're not looking at the short term, which has already been mentioned, that the effects are right here in front of us already. We have rising ocean levels that are affecting seaside communities. We have ocean temperatures that are affecting ocean life and our ability to harvest fish from the food. That has been declining. We have droughts and wildfires happening already right in front of us. And yes, the U.S. Navy is very concerned about what's going to happen in Newport Roads, where they are not going to have the use of their most important naval base. So yes, the effects are right here, and we need to communicate that. But also, we need to think way beyond 2100 because time doesn't end somehow at 2100. Our grandchildren's grandchildren need a world that they can live in. And we think that where we project with a linear projection. Right now, 4.5 to 5 millimeters of ocean rise per year gets us to around that 1.5 to 2 foot increase in ocean levels by 2100. But we already have evidence that that in itself is increasing. Glaciers are moving faster. Greenland and Antarctica are starting to contribute to the rising waters.
That it's not linear change. Yeah. Martin, I take your point, and thank you so much for your call. And just FYI, yes, we realize that time does not, it's not that it stops in 2100, but it's a place at least to put this thought experiment. But Emily Atkin, do you want to respond to Martin?
Sure. I'll just say that, of course, yeah, I take his point totally. Yeah. The reason the piece focuses on 2100 is because there's a lot of scientific literature on 2100. There's a lot of scientific literature on 2050 as well. But I wanted to paint a full picture, as full as I could, a full science-based picture on what the future might look like. And so, you know, a lot of people told me I should choose 2050 or 2030. It was, I guess, an arbitrary choice.
Yeah, I also just want to say that it's obviously a framework to get us to think about the future, not a presumption that the problem stops in 2100.
Yeah, I mean, our problem with climate change is that it's always just been seen as this too far off thing, and we're all like, well, later.
Yeah. Well, so let me ask you about two other quick points that Martin made about that, in fact, the pace of change is not linear, that it's actually getting faster every year. And, you know, how does that factor into what we can do to pull back the effects of climate change?
I mean, all I know is that I have only been doing climate change reporting for 6 years. And in the last 6 months, I have seen a major shift in how the public consumes information about it. The reality that they're willing to accept, the types of activists who become, you know, famous and mainstream. I mean, I moderated a panel in front of members of Congress with Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old Swedish activist who sailed here on a boat. And her speech was one of the few I've heard that just made me stop taking notes and just listen, because it was so real. It was so science-based, and it was just... And everyone, you could hear a pin drop in the room. And even that, you know, the pace of change for the last 5 years has been slow, slow, push, push, push. And all of a sudden, in the last 6 months, I see something happening. So I mean, that's, I know this is a really despairful, depressing story, but it's not just gloom and doom all over the place.
Yeah. Well, Francesca, let me turn back to you here because, dovetailing on what Emily just said, and our caller Martin was talking about sort of the downside of using the language, or at least some of the language of science in these kinds of conversations. I mean, I hear what Emily's saying, that in the past 6 months maybe that's changed a lot, but science is typically, you know, they're not going to say anything is 100% certain. That's simply not how science works. But perhaps this is a time now where we need to inject a lot more urgency into our conversations and our decision-making around climate change. I mean, would you even say that we need to adopt a kind of framework that we had after 9/11, when the entire approach to terrorism became top line, top of mind, and the most urgent action that the United States could take?
Yeah, I think it's really important to understand that the security community, including our intelligence agencies and the Defense Department, for example, are very science-driven. And when they're looking at security risks on a range of levels, whether it's the spread or proliferation of weapons of mass destruction or global terrorism issues, there's a lot of uncertainty. But even if something is a low probability, high consequence risk, for example, the possibility of a detonation of weapon of mass destruction, the security community obviously puts significant resources, and there's a lot of political will that goes into making sure that security scenario doesn't happen. On climate change, we have even greater certainty. And I would argue, and I think this is consistent with the way the broader security community thinks here in the United States and also elsewhere, is that while we're looking at unprecedented risks from climate change, and I think the security community believes that, we also have an unprecedented level of foresight when it comes to our climate future. The models that we've been using, including the oldest climate models, are incredibly accurate and usually actually actually quite conservative when in terms of projecting our climate. So we actually have a pretty good picture of what the global climate is going to be doing compared to a picture of other kinds of security issues that are a little bit harder to predict. So since we have unprecedented risks but also unprecedented foresight about those risks, we can see this coming. And as Emily was saying before, I mean, this was forecast for us back in the 80s, you know, and you know, that we, because of those two things together, I think we have a responsibility to prepare for this, for this risk, and to actually prevent the more catastrophic ones, just like we have a responsibility to prepare for and prevent other major security problems that we face.
Okay. So if the national security establishment is already recognizing and wanting more policy and decision making focused on climate and its impacts, how do we bridge the gap between that and what we actually hear some elected officials say? Because, I mean, I'll just give you an example. Emily, you mentioned Greta Thunberg, the Swedish climate activist, the 16-year-old. She did testify before a U.S. House committee just yesterday, and she told American lawmakers that other nations, including hers in Sweden, are using U.S. inaction as an excuse to do little to address the threat of climate change. And then during one point of her testimony, Louisiana Republican Representative Garrett Graves had a series of questions for Greta Thunberg, asking her about what she would do if she were cleaning up trash in the ocean. It was an analogy that he used about the differing effects of national action. And here's that interaction.
Let me ask you a question. If you're sailing across the ocean and you're picking up trash along the way, and for every one piece of trash that you pick up, there's a boat right next to you dumping out five pieces, how would that make you feel?
First of all, we were going so fast, there wasn't enough to pick up any trash.
All right. Well, if you were a slow sailor like me, how would that make you feel?
Well, first of all, if you use that logic, then I am also dumping a lot of trash in the ocean. And then I would stop dumping my trash in the ocean and tell the other boat to stop dumping their trash in the ocean as well.
So that's climate activist Greta Thunberg testifying before the U.S. House committee, before a U.S. House committee just yesterday, in conversation there with Louisiana Republican Representative Garrett Graves. Now, Francesco Femia, the reason why I wanted to play that for you is Graves was getting to a point which we hear frequently amongst national-level lawmakers in this country, that the U.S. action on climate change, like, why right now should the U.S. act aggressively when nations like India and China continue to be major consumers of energy and contributors to climate change? That is the difference between what political leaders say versus what I'm hearing you say there is emerging consensus on in the national security establishment.
Well, I think it's because if you consider the United States, and I think many in our community do, as a nation that should lead, then it's problematic if we step away from the table and use the excuse that, well, hey, China and India aren't doing enough anyway, and they're the top polluters, or China's the top polluter, and therefore, you know, it's a game of chicken, and why should we, be suckers in that game? And I think that's just the wrong way to look at, you know, U.S. Leadership potential. Also, I'd say that, you know, there's certainly an effect, and I think we're already seeing it, when the U.S. steps away from the table and decides not to lead on addressing this issue, then that gives permission to other nations to not take it seriously as well. And I think that gives permission to, you know, for example, the Brazilian government to pull back on its own commitments, and also others. And so I think that's problematic. And honestly, I do think from a security perspective, though, you know, no matter what China and Russia do, we do need to make sure that we make investments in climate adaptation, but also in reducing our emissions, just because of the security consequences of climate change and what that'll do to U.S. national security. And we haven't really talked about it much, but climate change is melting the Arctic, creating a whole new ocean. China and Russia are taking advantage of that new geostrategic environment. In the South China Sea, we have fish stocks moving northward. That's going to bring the Chinese Navy in conflict with fishing fleets from neighboring countries. That brings the United States into the conflict potentially. And so we have a changing geostrategic environment that may be in some cases potentially benefiting our adversaries. And some like Russia are actually better prepared than the United States to operate in the Arctic. They have over 40 icebreakers, whereas we have two. And so I think we should just be concerned about what it's doing to the geostrategic environment, what that means on a national security level. So even if you're not thinking altruistically about what the U.S. should be doing in the world, climate change is bad for us in terms of, our relationship with other great powers like China and Russia. And should we do something on that level as well?
Can I just add something really quickly about that exchange with Congressman Graves and Greta? I just want to add to my point earlier when I said that the reason we haven't done anything for a long time is because a lot of very big moneyed interests haven't been, don't want us to do it. Garrett Graves is one of the top recipients of oil and gas money in the entire 435-member United States Congress. And he's taken over $500,000 from PACs and individuals affiliated with the oil and gas industry over the course of his career. And that is more than he's received from any other industry. And it's more than – I mean, in the 2018 election, he received more money from oil and gas than all but six current members of Congress. I mean, I'm not saying he doesn't actually believe those things, but I'm saying that, he's there for a reason. He's asking those questions to Greta for a reason.
Mm. Well, let's go to Clay, who's calling from Townsend, Vermont. Clay, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking the call. Hey, I wanted to briefly comment that I think the way that you intro to the show today is part of the problem of people understanding that climate change is here. Because in your intro, you said, what are your thoughts on climate change, or do you think it's all just fear mongering? And we're beyond the question of whether it's all just fear mongering. We know that climate change is real and that it's happening, and so to keep asking that question, I think, degrades the science and the reality of what's actually happening.
Hey, Clay, thank you. Actually, I want to say thank you for your call and your observation there, because it gives me a chance to explain why we do that, because there's not 100% uniformity of opinion on climate change across this country. There may be an emerging consensus, but not everyone feels the same way. And I just try to find ways to be sure to keep an open table here so that folks, Americans who might not think it's as urgent of an issue, feel that they can call in and share their thoughts, and we can engage with those people as well. So it's kind of more of a rhetorical device than any kind of desire to undercut science. But Clay, I really appreciate your call and pointing that out as well. Emily Atkin, we've just got a minute and a half here left to go. Clay's call actually leads me to a really interesting thing that you wrote in your piece about Bill McKibben saying that for, maybe 15, 20 years, folks who are concerned about climate change have been approaching this as an argument, right? An argument to be won versus an actual fight. Can you tell us what McKibben told you and why you think that's really important?
McKibben spent his life, the last 30 years writing books, thinking that if he just simply said the facts about climate change, about what the national security community said, about what the science said, that he could just win this argument with people who are saying that it wasn't real. And then after so many years, because of all the money and the influence, he realized that just the idea that this was a good faith argument, that there was one side that really didn't think that, that really didn't think that climate change was real, and all he had to do was provide the information, that wasn't legitimate, that it was just a tactic to keep delaying so that these industries could keep making money, because every single year of delay is a year of profits. And man, have those profits been amazing.
Well, Emily Atkin's new piece in The New Republic is titled The Blood-Dimmed Tide: Climate Change is Poised to Alter the Face of Global Conflict. We have a link to it at onpointradio.org. Emily, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Francesco Femia, co-founder of the Center for Climate and Security. Francesco, thank you so much as well.
Thanks, Meghna.
And by the way, on Monday, the UN Climate Summit convenes in the United States in New York. We will be there in New York to talk about the world's resolve, to take a measure of the world's resolve to really halt climate change. So that's coming up on Monday. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.